Welcome to Worlds Apart. After decades of congratulating itself on the long peace, Europe is now in the midst of a bloody and possibly quite protracted conflict. What led to it and how long it may take until peace returns? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Gunnar Beck, a European Parliament member representing Alternative for Germany. Mr. Beck, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for being available.
My pleasure. Good afternoon to you.
Now, let me start with a personal question, because Alternative for Germany, even in Russia, is often portrayed as this party of, I don't know how to put it diplomatically, somewhat crude and not particularly enlightened voters. And yet, judging from your academic background, you have an advanced degree in law. You taught in Oxford and the London School of Economics. You wrote a book on Immanuel Kant. With such a scholarly and intellectual background, why did you opt for this particular party?
Well, let me make two points. First, it's correct, yes, I did study not just law, but philosophy and politics at Oxford University, and I've written books on Immanuel Kant, Legal Reasoning, and the European Court of Justice. These are scholarly books, and they are not overtly political. Now, there is a common misconception that if you've received a decent education, you will inevitably turn into a good, politically correct, liberal internationalist and perfectionist. That is not my view. I think the purpose of education is to make you critical, including self-critical and enlightened. And it should enable you to question received wisdoms and prevalent opinions. And that's what I've been doing all along. Now to my second point, the AfD. The AfD is a young party. And what you've tried to put rather, possibly diplomatically, I think there are two things to bear in mind. We are a young party, which means we have lots of amateur politicians. It is correct to say that some of my colleagues have perhaps not always chosen the most nuanced and diplomatic way of putting it. However, in matters of politics, you also sometimes have to be polemical to express uncomfortable truths. And then secondly, you can imagine we are a party that is questioning practically every aspect of the political consensus in West Germany, in particular, since the war. There's a relentless campaign being waged against us by the publicly owned and financed media, just as there is currently a relentless propaganda campaign against Russia and President Putin, fought by the same media in Germany.
Speaking about the matters of politics, I know that in the European Parliament, you're a member of the Identity and Democracy Group, as well as a participant of the Conference on the Future of Europe. How do you see the relationship between identity and democracy, and do they have any place in the future of Europe?
Well, two questions really you are asking here. The relationship is a close one. We know of very few democratic countries that don't have a strong sense of identity. Usually that's a sense of national identity, but there are exceptions. Switzerland is a very good example, although you could say they have a sense of national identity based on a particular political emancipation struggle against imperial powers around them. So it's Switzerland has an identity which is multinational, and the same to some extent could be said about the United States. However, in Europe, democracy has generally evolved in the context of nation states. Now to the second part of your question. Well, there the answer is fairly clear. Both democracy and identity, especially national identity in Western Europe, are under threat. Mrs. von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, has announced that she wants to bring dozens of millions of non-European people to Europe in the next 10 to 15 years. In my view, national identity cannot survive such a massive influx of people that have no cultural roots in Europe. And if I may, a third point, I've done the calculations on that roughly. At present, one third of Germany's population is partly foreign in origin. If present trends of immigration continue, even at a diminished level, and if the German birth rate remains as low as it is, Germany will cease to be a majority German country by something like 2035.
Mr. Beck, can I stop you here for a second? Because I'm sure you know what the people on the other side of the political spectrum would say. They would see your comments as xenophobic, but having read what you have said about migration, I think you are making more of a sort of social and institutional argument that it takes you know, a certain percentage of people rooted in society, rooted in its culture, rooted in its ways of lives to preserve that way of life and to develop it and to move it forward. Why do you think, and I mean, the field of sociology is so well developed across Europe. I mean, there is a department of sociology in any major university. Why is it not taken as a practical consideration? Why is it always discussed within the framework of ethnicity or skin color, whereas, you know, traditions, they do have certain and very practical value for ensuring stable and comfortable lives?
Well, you've put my point very clearly. I need to elaborate on it. I think a society can be destabilized by very great rapid changes, also in the sphere of immigration. Now, why isn't this perfectly sensible view, which was commonplace in Europe until about 30 years ago, nowadays ostracized as some kind of ultra-xenophobic view. Now, the reason for this seems to me quite clear, because the kind of liberal agenda we see in the West now is not really reason-based, but it's a kind of quasi-religious creed. And they are trying to crowd out all sorts of realistic, practical objections to their vision of creating a kind of city on the hill on earth.
Okay, can I ask you about one other thing that has much more direct relevance to where I am in Russia and where my relatives are in Ukraine? I'm talking about the war in Europe. And I think here again, another very important European tradition was if not broken, then totally rejected. And I'm talking about this notion of the European balance of power or balance of security, because Europe, as we all know, has had many wars, but one of the results of that war is a certain diplomatic and international relations culture that is rooted in the balance of interest, in the balance of power. And for a long time, it was respected, and you know, one could argue that the long peace that I mentioned in the beginning was also a result of that. But this tradition seems to be fully rejected in the case of Ukraine, because no Russia's security interests are even taken into consideration and haven't been taken for quite some time. And secondly, the Europeans have fully put all their, you know, security sensibilities in the American basket. Why would it happen to Europe that has been tried and tested by war for such a long time?
Well, the sad fact is that the last great European war is now, what is it? It happened 80 years ago. My mother experienced it as a child, and the last thing she would ever want is another war. And her generation, for the most part, is prepared to do almost anything to avoid it. But most Europeans are much younger now, and we've seen significant changes in the educational system, where history often starts in the post-war era. So much is forgotten. I think that is one reason. Secondly, I think you are slightly misrepresenting the tradition of realism in European thinking. I agree, it's a very important tradition, but because Europe dominated intellectually for several centuries, practically all other traditions of liberal, of international relations also originate in Europe. So if you take Immanuel Kant, he was the first to introduce the notion of a League of Nations. This is a more ideal regarding tradition in European international relations thinking. So the realist tradition is one important one, but you're absolutely right, it's been forgotten. I think the reason is partly that Europe is a much diminished continent. The Europeans don't lead anywhere any longer. And if you're in a position of impotence, what some people do is they want to be at least the last, the greatest moral superpower on the world, in the world. And I think that's part of what is motivating Europe here. It's certainly motivating Germany.
Well, you know, I'm studying psychology on the side. I have a great interest in depth psychology of Carl Jung, and he has actually explored the trends in the collective unconscious quite extensively. He wrote a lot about the Nazi phenomenon as a suppression of who you truly are. And, you know, when I see these people that you're also referring to, only concerned with the future, only concerned with their illusions, and not being informed by the past, by their own history, it comes across as a form of self-alienation. And that form of self-alienation, we know it from psychology, always produces hatred, and not just hatred of somebody else. It's usually also self-hatred that then is projected onto other nations. Do you think it has anything to do with the current demonization of Russia, or perhaps other countries like China or Iran?
It's slightly monocausal what you are saying, and of course, but there is this element. Friedrich Nietzsche, in his characterization of certain religions, makes a very similar point. I've myself made the point that impotence may be at the source of it, a diminished position of power. I think in the case of Russia, there's another element. Russia is little understood in Western Europe. A final point is that West Germany in particular has been integrated into Western structures for 70, 75 years now. With it went a very great amount of propaganda. Integration into Western systems of thinking through education. If you look at East Germany, I come from West Germany, but in East Germany, I think there is much greater skepticism towards the received Western liberal narrative. So it's partly an East-West divide in Europe. Of course, at present, the matter is complicated, and from Russia's position, not necessarily in a favorable way, because only 30 years ago, 35 years ago, the Soviet Union dominated Eastern Europe. So I think the prevalence set of concerns in Eastern Europe is security concerns.
Okay. Well, Mr. Beck, we have to take a very short break right now for the sake of our editorial security, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Forward to talking to you all.
That technology should work for people.
A robot must obey the orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law.
Show your identification.
We should be very careful about artificial intelligence.
The point, obviously, is to create trust rather than fear.
I would like to take on various jobs.
I mean, with artificial intelligence, we are summoning the demon.
Yeah.
A robot must protect its own existence.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Gunnar Beck, a European Parliament member representing Alternative for Germany. Mr. Beck, before the break, we discussed this multifaceted and very complicated attitude that some Germans have towards Russia. And I've heard you say in one of the other interviews that many of your colleagues at the European Parliament are filled with hatred, not only for Russia, but for the kind of conservative traditionalism that Russia represents. Do you think these people who are filled with hatred, do they even understand what Russia tries to leave out in the world, what it tries to base its identity on?
Well, you have to realize in the European Parliament, we have about 1 or 1.5 minutes. So I often have to use shorthand. Traditional conservatism was such a shorthand. I think there are other factors at play. Of course, in Russia, I think certain basic issues such as a decent standard of living are still very important. The government has been very concerned about securing basic comforts to the population. That's one aspect. And the other point is, in Europe, I think historical education has suffered. So for many Europeans, they tend to reject everything prior to something like 1960s. So the history starts with the sexual and cultural revolution of the 1960s. And they reject anything that went on before. So I think that is part of the problem. Most of our decision makers in Europe now operate in a strictly ahistorical manner. They sometimes draw historical parallels, but they are very ill-informed.
Now, you mentioned the Russia's government focus on the standards of living, and European politicians on the contrary often talk about aspirational and inspirational values, but ensuring basic safety, ensuring basic services is not just a value, it's a duty of the government. And maybe it's just my Russian bias, but I wonder if part of the problem here is indeed the conflict between governmental duties and governmental aspirations, and the total rejection of the Europeans of the former, because if we analyze the recent decisions, including the abandoning of all trade with Russia, it looks like the living standards of European citizens are not the first priority.
Absolutely. I think for the last 25 years, living standards for at least half the population in most of Europe have not improved. It's as simple as that. Now they are declining as a result of the inflation, which is at least partly a result of the corona lockdowns plus the events in Ukraine. And the kind of inspirational and aspirational value catalog that our politicians are constantly evoking, these ideas are very far removed from the concerns of most people. So yes, in that respect, you're absolutely right. Most European governments are failing their people.
And possibly that's also what it's at the core of the Ukrainian crisis, because I think the government of Russia for years have been stating that they have a duty to protect their country's security interests. It's not just an aspirational value. It's something that we have to act upon. We have our military for that precise reason. But all we heard in response was some aspirational values of some European politicians and the Ukrainians. Now, I wonder if this dilemma between, you know, hard duties and aspirational values, if it could have been resolved without an armed conflict, given your understanding of what's been happening in Ukraine, not from February of last year, but a couple of decades prior to that.
I think you've given me a broad time horizon that makes answering the question easier, because I think there have been very little. I mean, the attitude of Russia in the immediate post-war, post-Soviet era towards Western Europe, and my own country in particular, has been remarkably generous. Very few countries have treated Germany as well as Russia has in the last 33 to 34 years. Russia agreed to reunification without demanding practically anything in return. None of our Western partners.
Mr. Becker, I just want to say that this is not the way Russia treated just Germany. This is a historic tradition of resolving conflict for Russia. It was the same case with Napoleonic Wars, Russia welcoming France back into the family of European countries, not taking any contribution. And it's a consistent and philosophical approach that the Russian state has taken over centuries, not just over decades,
but
over
centuries. I gave you the one example that I know about best. So what there was, if you want me to put it in more general terms, there was a very distinct approach to seek closer relations with Western Europe. And that's been largely, although not wholly, rebuffed. So there was very little that Russia got in return. So if you constantly make concessions, if you constantly make overtures, and very little comes in return, well, then at some stage you may change your approach. And I think what we have to realize is that Europe, together with and driven on by the United States, did move ever closer to Russia. And Russia accepted a great deal of eastward expansion. So the Europeans thought, and the Americans, I assume, they could just march ever forward. And they are now surprised that Russia doesn't agree. Now, the Europeans, I think, are genuinely surprised. The Americans, I think, have a more rational attitude. They regard it more as a kind of power game. The Europeans are often distracted by their own idealist thinking.
Well, I guess it's easy to be an idealist when times are good. And I've heard many experts say that the EU-US partnership was always on American terms, but at least you had the benefit of foreign direct investments and relatively fair trade. But it's no longer the case. I think the terms of your partnership are changing very rapidly. You are bound to give much more and receive much, much less. The American policy towards Europe is pretty hawkish, if not predatory, at this point of time, given the industrial capacities that are being transferred to the United States. Now, how long do you think it will take until the European voters, not the European politicians, but the European voters will feel the pinch and will demand something different from their leaders?
Well, you've chosen very harsh words, hawkish and predatory. I'd like to defend the United States in this regard. They are just being rational from their own point of view. I think it's the European reaction that's very naive and foolish. It's the fault of the Europeans primarily, who've allowed themselves to be put in that position. The United States is just doing what's in their interest, to be fair. But you are right in another respect. I think after the war, during the Cold War, the United States required compliance in military and foreign policy matters, but they in turn could guarantee high living standards. That's come to an end. The alliance with the United States, Western integration, is becoming increasingly expensive for Europe. Many Europeans, as yet a minority, are awakening to it, but hardly any of our politicians are. So there is a dichotomy. How long it will take, I cannot tell you.
By the way, can I ask you, this is something that is absolutely puzzling to many of us in Russia, in particular those who live in St. Petersburg, which is a city with huge German heritage and very strong cultural ties with Germany. And this is also a city where many of the gas projects originated. For example, the Nord Stream pipelines were built from that side of the Baltic coast. And given all the explosions and the recent statements, for example, from Hungary Prime Minister Orban saying that he doesn't exclude a possible repeat of such incidents, I just wonder, do you think the Europeans would ever want to know what actually happened to, you know, their own energy infrastructure? Aren't they, I mean, I understand their fear of Russia, but aren't they fearful that something like that could happen in Europe at this day and age?
Well, these are very clear questions. I can give you clear answers. No, the European governments don't want to know. The European people, for the most part, have a suspicion what happened.
They couldn't care less, or what?
There is an oppressive climate which makes it very difficult to call a spade, because our governments have systematically avoided any serious investigation of who carried out the attacks. They are intimidated. They do not wish it. They know, but they don't wish it to be widely known.
I don't know if you've heard of that, but Russia has experienced a number of terrorist attacks by Ukrainian militants just today. And I think it's pretty clear that if the war will come ever closer to Russia, Russia will respond. Do you think people in Europe understand that, the time for illusions is over? There is a real war on the ground in Russia, in Ukraine, and if it continues, it may come to Europe as well.
No, they don't understand that, properly speaking. I think some people have some kind of amorphous fear, but the last great war happened so long ago that most people think this matter can somehow be localized. If they were fully aware that this war may escalate, and because there's an interesting paradox, let's assume the West is right and they can really push Russia, get Ukraine to push Russia back.
How? Can you spell out how they envisage that?
Let's assume by just arming you. I'm just trying to summarize what some people are thinking in the West. They will arm Ukraine to such an extent that because Russia isn't sending its whole army in, they may push Russia back. I don't think that most Europeans have an adequate conception that in these circumstances, a great power like Russia will respond with any means at its disposal. I'd like to leave it undetermined as that. I think it's clear what I mean. I don't think most Europeans are aware of this. Absolutely not.
And so would the United States, or so would China. I mean, it's international politics 101. I mean, it's the basic thing that people study in international affairs class. Now, can I ask you the very last question? Because you don't sound very optimistic, but what's your best hope for the next couple of years as far as Russia, Europe, and the whole world is concerned?
Yes, you're right. I'm not by disposition an optimist, and the last decade has generally proved me right. But obviously, we have to do what we... Ken Luther said that even if the world were to end tomorrow, we should plant at least one last tree. So I think we have to reach an understanding in Ukraine. This war has to be brought to an end. I can't give you an easy solution of what this might be, but what I do know is that this war is a grave danger to Europe, and it's already wrecking our economy. It's not doing anyone any good, certainly not in Europe. So we have to do what we can to end it.
Mr. Beck, it's been a great pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you, and I couldn't agree more with your last words. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.